the time and get crazy, have some fun. Hello and welcome to the Dad Podcast. With me today is our very own stand-up pediatrician, Dr. Jay Soute.
How you doing there, Justin?
I'm doing good, man. Lots to talk about with Dr. Jay. We've been playing schedule roulette between the two of us the past month, I feel like, is what's been going on. Not only have you and I been playing schedule roulette, but I've had a lot of good time. So actually, I didn't think about this when we first started talking, but it would be fun to get your opinion on this.
Sure.
And I'm going to do another. People have already heard all this story by the time this episode comes out, but we'll make it brief. I haven't put out episode in probably like, I want to say 2 or 3 weeks. And it's because on the 22nd of May, I had a hernia surgery.
You did.
Yeah, I had the inguinal. Is that the right?
Inguinal hernia.
And it's not a big deal. Everything's fine. If you don't know what that is, don't Google image it, because then you're going to think that I am some kind of freak show. Google image does not do hernias any good. I had I have a mesh put on about half of my pelvis right now. And there was lots of people who heard on the news that mesh is no bueno, but I guess it's just the vaginal mesh.
Mesh, which you don't have to worry about, apparently.
As far as I understand, they did not put any mesh in my vagina, but I am not a doctor, so I can't say that. I cannot confirm nor deny it. But and then that was good times. Before that, my wife, for I think it was back in April, is when all this started for her. She found a lump in her breast.
Oh, no.
Yeah, and she's got, like, no exaggeration. I'm not trying to make light of breast cancer, because I'm sure this cancer in some way, shape, or form has touched everyone in that's listening to this show, I'm sure. Yeah. So I don't mean to make light of it, but literally everyone in her family has had breast cancer, like her aunts, uncles, no. Her aunts, her grandmothers, her mom had it when she was 16. Even her sister, who's adopted, like it was insane.
Do they have the broken gene?
She checked a long time ago. I can't remember when or why it came up. It was way before this lump thing. She got tested for the BRCA or BRCA gene.
BRCA.
So she got tested for the BRCA gene. She pronounces it BRCA. Maybe it's for. It's the Obama gene she actually got tested for. I don't know.
Well, that's the Macarena.
That's the Macarena. Okay. That's also, there's so many genes. There's a lot of genes, guys. We should map them. And so anyway, she tested negative for that. So we were like, oh, that's great. And then it's funny because they say to you, well, that doesn't necessarily mean that you don't have it, right?
It means you don't have the gene. It doesn't mean you won't get breast cancer.
Correct. I'm sorry. Thank you for correcting me on that. And so she found this lump, and it was very happenstance. Like, it was just one night. It was like, oh, hey. And then she obviously had me check it out. And so I was like, and I could feel it. And so I was like, I don't know. It doesn't seem like a big deal or whatever, but thankfully she's who she is. And so she went to the doctor, blah, blah, blah. So we've been kind of wrestling. There was issues with biopsy. I want to abbreviate this, because they will have heard like it in length already. And obviously, long story short, she had the lump removed on the 12th of June. Everything is great. Everything is fine. They got the results back last week. Everything is benign. So that's a good
thing. That's terrific news. But that's 2 months of hell, you know, to wait and finally get the answer.
And thankfully, we have an amazing physician who, when there was a beginning snafu, like she got all up her staff's ass about how, and basically made it clear, like, she's like, listen, this is an umbrella directive that if we have a female who is dealing with a lump, that is very high priority. That is not stuff that just gets set on a desk. That is stuff that we need to stay on top of, because these people are sitting on pins and needles waiting to find out. And
right.
I talked to my wife. When my wife first found out, she was obviously very nervous, very upset. And I said, hey, listen, I don't think it's smart to worry about anything until you know you got something to worry about, right?
That's always been my philosophy. Ben Franklin said, do not worry about things that may never come. Stay in the sunshine.
Right. I said, you could burn all these calories thinking about the worst case scenario. And that's what our minds are wired to do. I've learned is that they're wired to protect us. So they focus on the worst case scenario so that you can be prepared. I said, and then find out, it's nothing. You're good. Which is essentially what happened. So thankfully,
again, it's a huge relief when you're stressing about it. But I'm not sure 2 months of stress is worth the trade-off of that one day of relief, you know?
Right.
Until daddy's got to have his hernia taken care of, and the next thing on the list comes up.
Well, and then after I had the hernia taken care of, about 3 weeks and almost 4 weeks to the day that I – so just the Friday before what would have been, 4 weeks, I think. I go to a Rams football camp with the kids, and I'm getting this pain in my gut, and I'm like, oh, geez, it's so uncomfortable. And so I sat out there, and then I had to set up for the birthday party, which is another thing everybody's already heard about. And so then Saturday I'm fine. Sunday I'm okay. Like, it's all, when I say fine, it's discomfort, but I don't feel the same pain I felt on Friday. Right. Sunday night, I spike a fever of 101.3, and the pain gets pretty bad, but not unlivable. And then Sunday, I sleep all night, but then Sunday morning, it's still there. So I'm like, I'm going to go to urgent care, blah, blah, blah. Long story short, thankfully, she was doing her follow-up visit with the surgeon, and the same surgeon did my hernia. And so he asked, how's Justin doing? She goes, well, he's got this pain in his abdomen. He went to urgent care today. And they said that he goes, oh, he might have diverticulitis. And they said, and he goes, no, they had him bounce up and down on his toes and ruled that out. And then they had blood work done. And he goes, no, get him in here now. So thankfully, he was a nice enough guy to work me in to his already packed day. And he laid two fingers on me, like pushed twice on the left side of my abdomen, and it hurt like hell. And he goes, yeah, you got diverticulitis. So he ordered antibiotics and a CT scan stat. He goes, I want you to take the antibiotics even before we get the results of the CT scan, because the antibiotics are only going to help and it's worth the risk right now. Like, he goes, this is not something you want to mess around with. The urgent care, in their defense, had asked me multiple times if I'd had a history of it, but I didn't know what it was. So I was like, no, I don't even know what that is. And they knew I had my appendix taken out, so they're like, well, it's not that, but they were confused. And my wife,
were they worried at all that it was related to the surgery, the mesh surgery?
No, because of where the pain was. The pain was nowhere near where the mesh was. Gotcha. It wasn't really around the surgical area. So they were like, and they said there's no inflammation, and they were more worried about the fever. They were like, wow, the fever and everything. Yeah. They just kept saying diverticulitis, but something about the way I was explaining something to them threw them off, I guess. And so they go, here's what I think we should do. They tested my blood and had it checked out to see if there was a white blood cell spike. Because he said, if you're fighting an infection and the white blood cell, then we know it'll help us narrow things in. He goes, and I just think that's smarter before we expose you to radiation or any kind of imaging. And I was like, all right. And so he did, and my white blood cell, everything came back normal. Well, the same thing happened when I had appendicitis, and I told him that. But they're like, no, it's fine. They go, just monitor it. If the pain gets worse or you spike a fever again, then you need to go to the ER, is what their advice was. And so they called the follow up, and obviously I had when the surgeon got the scan back, he said, you have a very extremely severe case of diverticulitis. Like, he goes, it's bad. He goes, we're lucky that we caught it in time. So he's got me on antibiotics for 2 weeks. I'm just finishing up a week of a liquid-only diet. The good news is I lost like 6 pounds. So that was great.
Good for you. That diverticulitis diet is terrific.
Oh, my gosh, right? It's funny because I've been it's like living at a Jamba Juice in my house. I've been eating nothing but smoothies and broth, and the good times have been rolling for me.
And you'll never eat corn again.
Well, that's the thing, is that I love nuts. He said, "Do you
eat
a lot
of any nuts anymore?"
Either. Right. So this is good, because he said, he goes, he told me obviously not to touch it for a while, but you're saying I should never have popcorn or nuts again.
Yeah, my one of my nurses, who's never had diverticulitis before, decided she was going to do a healthier diet, which was going to include more nuts. So she has nuts on her desk at the office, and she's been eating the nuts for like a month now, and she was out Thursday and Friday with a case of diverticulitis. So,
and this is I don't know, for people listening, I don't, like, a lot of people seem to know about this. I knew nothing about it, and it's pretty bad. Like,
Well, even it's like a little outpouching of your intestine that certain foods can get stuck in, and then it causes inflammation and infection. And these little diverticulum, if they become infected, can rupture. They can also seed the bloodstream with gut bacteria.
Right. And he said, he goes, what we need to make sure is that if we can get you better, he goes, what we don't want is a perforation.
Right.
He said, if it perforates, he goes, that's bad. He goes, I got to go in and take out about 7 inches of your colon. And then you're going to have to roll around with a colostomy bag for a few months while
you're
going to
have a bag.
Out.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I was like, are you kidding me? And then another friend of mine, she told me, and I felt horrible, but she was like, she goes, yeah, one of her friends, but they struggled with it. It seemed like for a while. And then they had a perforation, had to have that surgery. And they passed away due to complications of that that surgery. And I was like, wow. You know, I mean, I'm knocking on the door of 40 in January. I turned 40, and it seems super sappy and cheesy, but like it kind of opens your eyes a little bit. I know it sounds like an after school special, but it really does. It kind of, when you're kind of like, oh, I'm fine. And you're trying to be the tough guy, not going to the hospital. And then this shit goes down. And then next thing you know, you think, oh, well, I'm glad they caught it because that would have been inconvenient. And then you have a friend who's like, yeah, I had a friend who didn't make it out of that. And
the
you
major
start
inconvenience.
Yes. Right. Yeah. And so I was like, I don't know. It's as cheesy as it sounds. This has really had me kind of reevaluate everything.
It's a serious thing. Plus, was the hernia surgery the first surgery you've had?
I had an appendectomy and then this hernia surgery. Those are the only two surgeries.
How
I've
old
had.
Were you when you had the appy?
Probably in my early to mid, mid 20s. It was 2003.
Oh, okay. So you've had those two. Because, yeah, I mean, both of those, you know, are major events. So, yeah, you do evaluate yourself. I stubbed my toe. I reevaluate my life.
Well, and it's funny because part of what we had planned to talk about, I think, is a little bit about that reevaluation is that, and I'd be curious because you've been through this, Doc, and it's, I don't think it's a part, it's become a part of your job as a pediatrician where we've talked about how you kind of become almost psychotherapist. And I talked a little bit about this with Andy on the last episode I did too. There seems to be this, I'm going through this phase of my children being, I'm very annoyed with my role as a parent, right? Like
refresh my memory. How old are your boys?
9 and 6 or 9 and 7. He just turned 7 last week. My apologies. Okay. But, and the other one's going to be 10 in September. And here's what my theory is, Doc. And you tell me what you think of this. My theory is that at this phase in parenting, I'm entering in where I have now for years been saying the same thing, right? So so my fuse is therefore shorter. For it feels like 5 years at least, I've been telling them to sit correctly at the table. And if I was to remove myself from this, I would look back and go, well, the reason you repeat yourself is because you have not created a deep enough line in the sand. There is enough there where they just don't feel like there's anything at stake. But there's a part of me that's like, these are good kids. Like, I feel like, even though I'm a guy who likes rules, I like the authoritative approach to parenting. That's my style. They're good kids, so I don't want to necessarily rule with an iron fist, you know, all the time.
You're not saying if you don't sit right in your chair, I'll break your leg?
No, I'm not yet. Not yet. But I feel like it's what's happening, which could be actually worse, as funny as that sounds. What's happening is I'm like, will you just sit in the fucking chair for crying out loud? How many times do you have to hear it? There's a lot of that kind of thing where there's a hair trigger going off in my pissed offometer.
Well, you figure by this point you've said it enough. They're old enough now to understand.
Right.
And that you shouldn't have to ask over and over and over again to do the same thing. But I can use my monthly office meetings with my staff as an example. I've had an office meeting every month for the last 25 years. And we talk about the same goddamn things every time because nobody does them. You know? Oh, by the way, I have a very important day tomorrow. Tomorrow is my 25th anniversary of starting as a pediatrician.
Wow.
July 1st, 1993.
Congratulations. That's awesome.
Yep. 25 years. Quarter century.
Wow. That's like, so when you hit 25 years of doing something you love like that, what does it feel like?
it feels like I can only do it another 10. Because there were good years, you know, before the electronic health record, before there were a million different insurance companies, before parents got entitled and obnoxious. There were some very nice years in there, but you know, the charm and joy of what I do is lost now. But I do enjoy the kids. You know, the kids come in. You know, I have a kid who, you know, I give them their shot at four, and they don't shed a tear, and they say, "Was that brave?" And I'm like, "Yeah, that was about as brave as you can possibly be." And when I see kids that are, you know, not crying and upset when I do it, I know that it's because they trust me.
Yeah.
You know, and it's a good feeling that, you know, have a teenager call and ask for an appointment just to come in and talk to me about something that was on his mind, that at 18, all of that time that I spent getting to know them, you know, it made an impression, you know.
So that's incredible. That's cool.
And my older daughter, my 27-year-old, got engaged 3 weeks ago. So I have that part of my life that will be starting soon.
Oof, what's that like?
Well, considering her fiance and his three brothers have been patients of mine since they were newborns, makes it a little easier for me. At least I know the kid probably better than she does. You know, and the family and everything. So that makes it easier. So that's exciting. That'll be next fall. And apparently the ex will be having her nuptials in early June next year. So I'm down to, if that happens, God bless them, I'm down to only 11 more months of alimony, but I can't let this fiance of hers, you know, walk out into busy traffic or ride a motorcycle or anything, because I got a lot of money riding on him.
You're this guy's angel. There's that.
I should be able to take out life insurance on him for the rest of the alimony, just in case something happens.
You know, I believe if I'm not mistaken, there. Well, he would have to agree to screening, I think, is the catch. But I'm pretty sure you could get life insurance on anybody. Like, yeah. I'm pretty sure.
Well, I have to have life insurance in case I croak, so my ex gets every penny she's entitled to.
Wow, that's a part of it.
Yeah, wow. I got to carry a policy just for the amount left of the alimony. I change the amount every year when I renew it.
Wow, that's interesting.
That I pay for.
When your kid is getting married, I'm fascinated by this. Do you find, like, how much does it matter the other family? Like, when you're looking at it, is there any part of you, like, that looks at just the kid, or are you more concerned, like, that you know his whole family, so you know that at least they come from a, it's not about royalty or royal blood.
But what made them. And I do think, I mean, you are marrying the family. You could say you're not, but you are. And, you know, in my case, I mean, I know everybody, so I don't really have to, you know, I've been through ups and downs and crises with the four boys. And so I feel like, I already felt like part of the family, but he's been here. He's been with my daughter since they were in high school, like 9 years now. So, I mean, I've always considered him the son I never had anyhow. So left-handed pitcher, you got to love a left-handed pitcher.
Oh, he played baseball when he was in
through
school?
High school. He did, yeah.
That's awesome. So you know, you have zero concerns, no nerves or anything about any of this.
They've lived together for a couple of years. They bought a house together about 3-4 months ago. And then he popped the question and politely called and talked to me a couple of days before to ask for my blessing, which I think every young man should do, is talk to the father of the bride and ask for their blessing. I thought that was very nice.
Yeah, that's
and, you know, I knew it was just a matter of time because, you know, they're perfect for each other. And God bless her fiance, because when he's not around, all of the pressure comes down on me. So she can mother hen him for the rest of her life.
what's that? I'm sorry if I'm, I hope I'm not prying. Please tell me if I am, but I'm fascinated by these life phases in parenting that, and this is seems so far away from me that what goes through your mind? Like when he, like, they've been together, you said, 9 years?
Yeah.
So you kind of had an inkling, I'm sure, right?
Yeah.
And then, so when the phone rings, does he call you?
And they broke up for 2 years in between. So they've been together like 11 years, but there was a 2 year hiatus, which I think was real important to strengthening their relationship. So both of them know it's, you know, when they got back together, they kind of figured it was for keeps, and that's what they were working towards.
And do you like, so does he call you for any other reason? So, like, I'm curious, like, when the phone rings and you hear his voice on the other line or see his name show up on the cell phone, do you already go, oh shit, it's that moment that's happening?
No, I thought he was calling me to phone in another prescription for allergy eye drops for him, which is usually why he calls. So,
And so, because here's the thing, I imagine, and I'm just trying to put myself in your shoes. I imagine that getting that phone call from a young man when you have a daughter, that it's a lot like getting proposed to a certain extent. You know what I mean? Where it's like it comes at you all at once, and there's a level of excitement and also trepidation. You know what I mean?
Well, it's a big step. And me being the father of the bride, the thing I'm most nervous about is the tradition of the father of the bride paying for the wedding, because that shit ain't going to happen. It's the only thing that gives me any cause. My rule is, you guys got four parents. All right. Both sets of parents are divorced. In fact, Rick's dad is on his fourth divorce. So bottom line is this: whoever sets the bar with what they're contributing, I'll contribute that amount. Yeah. And if I want to contribute anything more, it's up to me. But I don't want to be, you know, pigeonholed into paying, you know, giving this kid a blank check to plan a wedding. Screw that idea.
Yeah, it's not 8 BC, right? It's 2018. Right. Let's do this right. Everybody's equal. Did you make that clear to him after he asked for your permission? Did you say?
I didn't say it to him, but Becca knows. I mean, I had said to her I wasn't going to pay anything for the wedding because after the divorce, I don't believe in the institution. So I'll pay for the open bar because I'm always going to believe in the power of alcohol. So.
You have said that before on the show. I remember.
I have. And I remember that. You know, that stands. I said, you can count on me for the bar. And I'll contribute whatever the other parents are contributing.
That's awesome.
And I told her, I said, if you got your mother to get married this June, I'd have that extra money I'm not paying to her to contribute to your wedding. So talk to her.
Yeah, apply the pressure. That's great. Can she sign off? Can she sign off for alimony now that she knows she's getting married? Can she like say, hey, no worries, you're good now?
She's been engaged for almost 4 years, so she could have signed off a long time ago. I got a feeling she's going to take. I'm going to probably have to, pay whatever the proportion. If she gets married on the 7th, I'll have to pay 7 days of alimony for the month. The way things have gone,
I gotta wonder if it's a stigma of being a doctor. Like you know what I mean? That because I just if I got a chick right and I'm moving in with her and she's previously married. And she's collecting alimony, and I feel like this is getting serious, where we're sharing a life together.
Right.
I got to tell you, especially when the kids are in their 20s, you know, like I just feel like I'd be like, hey, you know what? Let's let Jay off the hook. Like, let's get him off the dime. I don't need, because there's something about knowing that you're somehow paying for my quality of life too.
They're going to Rome on my dime.
I'm sorry, I'm laughing, Jay, but it's such a funny dynamic to me.
Renting a beach house on the beach in Rhode Island for a week at the end of July, all courtesy of the idiot that works 60 hours.
And I'm sure if I was to do a podcast with them, they would say, "Well, we work. That's money that we pay for." You know what I mean? Like it's not like they're. They're just sitting at home playing Fortnite against each other.
Right.
In separate
rooms.
Oh,
you know what else is interesting that I have become aware of is that part of our president's tax cut bill has alimony paid. Right now, I get to deduct dollar for dollar. Every dollar of alimony I pay, I get to deduct for my taxes. But if you get divorced after January 1st of this coming year, 2019 – alimony is not going to be deductible anymore. And I don't know how many people know this, and anyone who has an impending divorce coming up should really look into it, because there's a lot of pressure for a guy to get divorced before the end of 2018 when he can still grandfather into having his alimony deductible. But after January 1st next year, according to the Trump plan, alimony, because Trump is looking for like a standard deduction for everybody. So he wants to get rid of individual deductions.
Yeah.
And alimony payment dollars are a big one that is going to disappear, in addition to there being a cap on your property taxes, a cap on your mortgage interest. I mean, there's a lot of things that we have always become accustomed to writing off that aren't going to be write-offable anymore. But I tell you, it gives pressure for the guys to get divorced this year, and it gives pressure to the woman to drag her feet until 2019. And you know the lawyers are going to drag their feet, because the longer they drag it, the more money they make. Forget what the law is. So that's an important little piece there for anybody out there that has got an impending divorce settlement coming up, and to look into that, because I've read it in two reliable places, and that you just would think that would be discussed a little bit more, don't you?
Yeah. Well, it's just going to be funny to
watch. Kids in cages are what are distracting us from what's really going to affect us in a year.
Right. That's it's just funny that we go from you finding out that your daughter is going to, you know, be married to her soulmate, and it ends with divorce tax advice from Dr. J.
Before we got on the air, we said we're going to talk about three things. We have not touched any of those subjects yet.
Okay. But so, I love it.
Just get on and we just talk, and where it goes, it goes. But I say that for people that are out there. I mean, I'm grandfathered in, I'll be able to deduct, but you know, that it's a big deal. And it also will influence what you agree to in terms of a settlement, because if you're not able to deduct it, you're not getting any of that money back.
Guys might draw a harder line in the sand for that. Yeah. What is a true measurement of a quality of life?
No quality of life is considered for the money earner in the equation, because, right, you know, they're allowed to maintain their standard of living. And I had to live on $130 every 2 weeks. So, you know, but kids' college got paid for. I'm out from under that. And I think it built up a little bit of character in me as a grown up. So
you're very good at sunny side of things, Dr. J. Very good at that.
Yeah. Well, I could look at it and say that it's another difficult thing that I accomplished. That's all.
All right.
I don't know how the hell I went to medical school. I think back about that. I said, there's no way I could have done that now.
let's take a break, and we'll come back and we'll talk sports and kids after these messages. So before we went to commercial, I mentioned doing sports and kids, but I was wrong, because I would rather talk about this here, because I found some audio on this very story, and I can't remember which one of us found this, if it was you or me, Dr. J, but I'm fascinated by the idea of this, and I imagine that you have a lot of strong opinions. What this is that there was a couple in Georgia who lost custody of their kid because they were giving him marijuana to help with his seizures.
They're 15-year-old kid, though.
Yes, 15.
It's not like it was a newborn.
Right. In fact, but I love the audio from this, so I'm just going to play some of this news clip that I found. Here it is.
For our son, it was a miracle for him.
Matthew and Susanna Brill say their 15-year-old son, David, went from having up to 10 seizures a day to being seizure-free for 71 days after he began smoking marijuana.
Have you ever had 71 days where he didn't have a seizure?
Never.
Currently, medical marijuana is legal in 29 states and Washington, D.C. 9 states and D.C. allow for legal recreational marijuana. But Georgia has some of the strictest marijuana laws in the country. Physicians are not allowed to prescribe marijuana for medical use, and it is illegal to sell or possess it. But the law does allow those with a state-issued medical card to possess low THC oil.
That the only way he could get a medical card would be a 6-year waiting list.
So the Brills say, frustrated with traditional prescription medication, they took matters into their own hands.
You're having to buy it illegally.
Yes.
Matthew Brill says he smoked the marijuana first to make sure it was okay before giving it to his stepson.
Attaboy, Papa. Yeah. that's like taking your Halloween candy tax, right? Like,
that's right.
I love this next part right here.
You guys got arrested.
Yes.
You both go to jail.
For 6 days.
The Brill.
I like that he said, you guys got arrested and you both go to, isn't that what going to jail is being arrested? Am I wrong?
the Hoosgow.
Yeah, they went to the, I don't know any other word besides Hoosgow. What's the pen?
The slammer.
There you go. That's a good one.
Couples were charged with reckless conduct after someone alerted the Georgia Division of Family and Children's Services.
Who is that neighbor? Like, so, okay, let's get into this, because to me, I don't know where you stand on the medical advantages of marijuana. Like, I feel like there isn't a lot of research behind this.
It's illegal, so you can't. Right. So research is very difficult to get done.
Now, say in a country like Amsterdam, where Amsterdam is or whatever, like you can.
Or Canada in a couple of months.
So, but right. So it's still in a couple months. What I'm saying is that I think you'd have to go to an area like Amsterdam to find a clinic that could run a research, any kind of research, because all of the evidence is anecdotal. This thing where they say it helps with the nausea for cancer patients, it helps with glaucoma, anxiety. Obviously it seems, but so what in your opinion, doctor, when they see this kind of evidence for their kid, where he takes a hit off some dope and he suddenly has, I mean, what, no seizures for 70 days? Like,
it is pretty amazing, because a lot of the medicinal marijuana that is used for seizures comes in the oils, and some of them are just CBD oil that doesn't have any kind of a high or hallucinogenic right. properties.
That's what I've learned here in California, is that THC oil makes you high, but the CBT right. oil is the one that's more like a pain reliever. They can use right. it in that case, right?
Yeah, and in Connecticut and probably across the country, with the significant opioid addiction from people that have right. had like back surgery or knee surgery, that get prescribed medicine and then, you know, aren't able to come off it and then become, you know, addicted to either off the street pills or heroin. A lot of people have, you know, gotten relief from their chronic pain from the medical marijuana program, too. So it may even have some. You know, help with the use of opioids, which is out of control.
Is marijuana technically not an opiate?
It's not. It's in the same. I mean, it's a Schedule 5, I think, medication. But that means it has to be closely monitored. If I have to certify a kid to be eligible for medical marijuana card, there's a lot of hoops to jump through just to get to that point.
So, like, help me and tell me. I know I'm throwing you way on the spot here, but so is an opiate, to be an opiate, is that like a category?
Narcotic. Almost like a, yeah, that's.
But is it like a DEFCON? Is that what makes it an opiate, or is it the actual makeup of the drug that makes it an opiate?
It's the powerful effects and the addictive potential that makes it dangerous.
That's what categorizes it. So it could come from a different plant than, say, like a poppy plant or something, you know, wherever you think heroin yeah. would come from, because that's a form of an opiate, right?
Right. But we eat poppy seed muffins
right.
and bagels.
So it could come from that, but it's the concentration and the dose. So right. you could have an opiate level acetaminophen, even though so that would come from an entirely different source, but it's how strong it is and the likelihood that it
analgesia.
Meanwhile, at the Hall of Justice.
All right, so now we got the connection fixed, it seems. What was the what was that fancy word when I said acetaminophen?
Well, if you think about it, you got all our pain medications, whether it's narcotics like Oxycontin, hydrocodone, fentanyl, And also, you know, Tylenol, Advil, Aleve, those are all pain medications too, except the Advil, Aleve, and Tylenol are non-narcotic. They don't have any kind of a potential addiction to them. And the other ones, which are very much more potent, you know, do have that addictive side of it. So you break them down into non-narcotic and narcotic pain relievers or analgesics, and pot is actually, in terms of the way they look at it in the law, is pot is on the same level as opioids, and so is the Adderall that I write for, the Ritalin I write for kids, are also considered a controlled substance because of the
strength.
And again, they're not, because of their addictive qualities, I guess, is it. It's They're considered in the same class of medicines as opioids. So when I don't write any prescriptions for any opioid medications, but I write quite a bit for stimulants for kids with ADD. And every time I do, I have to go to the state controlled medication site, check and make sure they're not getting their prescriptions filled by another doctor and getting more medicine. And they're all the same hoops that you have to jump through for opioids. You have to jump through for the stimulants. Cause I got 6 year olds selling them on the playground, you know?
Wow.
No, no. But I'm saying, I'm the, you know, you got a little kid and the parents are managing it. Yeah. Maybe you have a parent that is sneaking them, but you know, for my patient isn't going doctor shopping to get 3 months worth of Ritalin in a month.
Not at the pediatric level. Right. Yeah.
Right.
And again, to go back to what I asked earlier, is that we don't know if the CBT oil in the marijuana, it is CB as in boy, or is it CV as in
CBD?
CBD.
Yeah.
So CBD oil is not as addictive because there's no real research on it. So we can't find out for sure because it's an illegal substance.
Right. And the only people that can do research on it are people associated with the government because they're the only ones that get access to the marijuana because it's illegal.
And you don't know of any research coming out of Europe or anything like that where they might be a little more loosey-goosey with such stuff?
No, but we know that it helps with a lot of things. It helps with pain. That's been shown. It does help with seizure activity. That's been shown. I don't know so much about the smoking part of it, but the research that has been done and there has been with the oils and it does tend to lower the severity of kids who have epilepsy and frequent seizures.
Right. If you can include the oil or even some kind of version of the chemical makeup of the oil in a pill or a capsule, the liquid gel for that matter, then you could have all of the benefits without the risks, associated with smoking it. Right.
Right.
So if we were to go back and look at this family, then really the downside for them is that they were having this kid smoke the marijuana, which, you know, is still technically.
And they live in Georgia.
Right.
You which know, is the which bigger... has very restrictive laws. Connecticut has medical marijuana. And tomorrow, actually, Massachusetts starts with the shit hits the fan tomorrow in Massachusetts when it becomes legal for recreational use. And they'll have all the stores open tomorrow, too, July 1st.
I still haven't partaken in our recreational California use yet. But
that's why I'm going out to San Francisco over Labor Day weekend.
Yeah, man.
Yeah. A little vacation. I got to see if I can pick up a little... tack myself on to a couple shows up in that area, but I'm going out with my buddy to see the Mets play the Giants out in San Francisco.
That's
great.
That's a beautiful park. I've never been in it, but that's a beautiful park for when I've seen it on TV.
It's one of the ones I'd like to see. So we decided we were going to do that.
That's fun. So it sounds, and it says in here later on in the audio I had is that basically, I think it was within 10 days of the kid being away from his parents, he was going back to having seizures.
Yeah.
Because he wasn't getting the CBD from the marijuana, at least. Now, what would you normally give to someone who had seizures?
Well, strong seizure medications, phenobarbital, valproic acid.
Are those opiates
like Valium? Pardon?
Are those opiates?
No, they're anti-seizure medications. They interrupt the electrical signals that keep the seizures going, and they can have side effects with them, gum hyperplasia. It can definitely make them sleepy and logy and take away their personality sometimes a little bit too. So they are fraught with side effects as well.
So tell me if I
and they're not 100%.
Right.
And obviously, I think this family said that they had exhausted all of traditional medical treatments for it. And it wasn't like this was their first choice. And nothing really worked for him despite being on medication. He was still having seizures.
Do you know, whenever I hear about stories like this, and I know it's easy for me to say because I'm not going through it and I've not done it, but I'm always shocked by the idea. And here's the thing. If you were to see these people, I think this is another part of the problem. If dad was rocking at least a polo shirt.
I'm looking at the picture of them on the couch in their trailer.
Yeah. And the, and if you look at the clutter in the background of the trailer, it doesn't really
neither pair likes sleeves apparently.
Right.
So
they are both card carrying members of the gun show, and they may when you listen to them talk, there may be a little bit of a dental situation, which. It's just a bad stigma. Like it's just they're not a good poster child for like, hey, let's illegally give your kid marijuana. But if I bet
they could have plenty of guns, but they can't get a joint for their kid so he doesn't siege. It's a weird time we're living in.
And I wonder if they lived in a gated community, right, and were rocking 2,000 square feet or more. In their living space, and Sonny Boy was going to a private school, you would assume that they then this wouldn't be an issue for them because they have money.
Right,
because
their nosy neighbor Mrs. Kravitz wouldn't have given them up to the authorities.
But wouldn't you argue that I would argue that it's that much more likely that would be an issue. I had a very interesting conversation with one of the moms at my son's birthday party last weekend. Was that we were talking about like the whole peanut out. I was going to set out a bowl of mixed nuts, ironically, unknowingly, while I had diverticulitis. And
you brought it back.
For some of the parents and stuff, because I thought, oh, it's a healthy snack. But then I'm like, oh, do we know if any of the kids have a nut allergy? And one of the mom, she goes, you know, I taught it for LAUSD, and she said, you know, we didn't have any peanut allergies and it was a mostly Hispanic area. And she goes, I can't help but wonder if it's if there's a genetic thing element to it. And I hearken back to our very own Dr. J breaking it on this very podcast that it has more to do with the fact that kids weren't being peanuts weren't being introduced into their diet until much later on in their lives. That was increasing the likelihood. Right. And I said, well, here's what I would argue. I said that while I'm not going to say race has something to do with it, I said predominantly a lower income bracket is going to have a higher number of minorities. But I would venture a guess that even whites within that lower income bracket are less likely to be prone to peanut allergies. Not completely. I'm saying less likely.
Right.
Because peanut butter is something cheap and it's a staple of, you know, I grew up eating peanut butter like crazy because we were super poor. And so therefore, that's why those kids are less likely. It's not necessarily a genetic thing. It could be. I'm not going to say it's not. Right. I'm not an expert. And I think you would agree with that statement. Not about me being an expert, but I'm saying I'm sure genetics play a role. But I think a greater factor is that idea that it's like, well, no, they're just giving their kids peanut butter because it's cheap and it's good food for them. Like it's a cheap way to fill the belly. And that a waspy mom who's going to read mom blogs and stuff like that in uptown Burbank or whatever you want to consider a more affluent area is going to go, oh, well, my pediatrician says I shouldn't be giving them peanuts for at least the first 8 months to a year. And therefore, there's going to be more kids in that neighborhood who are going to have peanut allergies, right?
I agree.
All right.
Yep. You're sounding a little overmodulated again, Justin.
Oh, crap. Thanks, Skype. Well, let's do this. Let's take another quick break, and then we will come back and talk kids and one sport after these messages. Don't need money. Don't take
fame. Don't need no credit card. It's crackling.
This is a story you sent me, I know, because I was shocked by this. But Dr. J found an article in the Washington Post that says playing one sport year round isn't smart, even for kids who want to go pro. The interesting points that they make in this article are that most of like the first round draft picks in the NFL draft were either played basketball and or baseball as well. I think for me personally, that lends to I feel like that's just because these people are just more athletes in general. Like they're just gifted athletes, right?
Yep.
But I think you would say to that, the thing that I thought was interesting is that another determining part of this is that they experience burnout or injuries due to essentially like the same repetitive movement of football. Have you Have you seen that in your own experience?
Absolutely. We see that all the time. They work on one specific skill set and exercise those muscles, and then they get overuse injuries from those particular muscle groups. They end up having injuries that require surgery. So if they rotate and do different sports that require the use of different, you know, groups of muscles, they're going to strengthen their whole body. They're not going to get tired of playing the same thing over and over again every day, and they're not going to have as many injuries.
Yeah, and because if they're moving different areas, they're strengthening these, right? How and why, like,
right.
Why is it that you would also assume that if you're using the same motion or whatever, that you would be strengthening that? Is like, how does that work out?
Strengthening it, but kids are still growing, so they haven't even reached their muscle mass that they're going to have full strength. So they're basically trying to do what, you know, somebody who has full strength with an immature set of muscles, basically, and immature connections with the tendons and ligaments, so that they're still growing, so they can more easily have these injuries come up.
So my goal should be to fall somewhere between Tiger Woods' dad and Todd Marinovich's dad in the spectrum. Although I don't know. I think they actually might be more on the same end of the spectrum now that I said that out loud. Yep. But is that? Here's my approach with sports and my kids. If whatever they're interested in, right? Like if I'm not, I don't necessarily steer them in any one direction. Like I think that the reason why my kids play football is because I like watching football. I'm sure that right. is a huge reason why. When it comes to Jacob, he really has developed a love for that game. He has zero interest in baseball, zero interest in basketball. Jack has an interest in basketball. Zero interest in
soccer.
Soccer. That's the one I was thinking of. Neither one of them. They'll play it a little bit in the backyard. Jack more so than Jacob. Jacob just really loves football. So the only thing I could think of that I'm kind of doing in this area is that they both also love hip hop dance because their street cred is strong, and so. Is that enough, do you think, or is it? Do I need to worry about making sure they're just not playing football 12 months out of the year?
Yeah, I think that's the more sensible approach. I mean, and it doesn't even have to be teen sports. It can be tennis. It can be golf. It can be boring bowling. I called it boring bowling, other things that just work different muscle groups and don't cause the. You know, kids get tired of the same thing over and over again. It takes a special kid to be 100% football all the time and to have that last, you know, throughout their playing years. I mean, most kids are not, there's no benefit to a kid to play one sport and intensely, you know, work out and train his muscles to do that before, you know, high school, really. So kids should just experience, you know, a bunch of different sports prior to high school. And if at that point they have one that they're particularly skilled at or one that they have more interest in, and then they can start to specialize a little bit more. But, you know, good athletes are going to play more than one sport usually. And then they're going to pick the one after their kids to see which one's going to make them the most money and not cause a lot of injuries.
And for those out there that have younger kids that haven't even gotten to this point, I think part of the reason why this article exists is that something that didn't happen when you or I were kids, Dr. J, is that now, like, let's take football, for example. My son is starting tackle football. He wanted to try it out this year. So he just did 3 weeks of, like, what they call summer preseason practice.
Good.
Then he gets a 3 week break, and then on July 23rd, he starts every night of Monday through Friday, 2 hours a day of doing intense practice to get in shape for tackle football. And then he'll do that for 2 months. Now he won't do anything from November until probably February later that year. But part of this same league is in the spring, they do a flag football league, and it's because they want the kids to be growing skills and learning skills. So, and the more they're doing it. And so I think, and there's travel teams and stuff. So I think the inclination would be that as a parent, I would get my son a coach to do agility drills and stuff with him during the 3 months that he's not playing. And then he would go into spring football and those. So therefore the more focused.
You're talking about an 11-year-old kid, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, that's the problem.
Right.
And he can only be, I mean, if he's only interested in one thing, that's fine. But doesn't mean he can't go for a run or a jog. It doesn't mean he can't shoot hoops. It doesn't mean he can't go ride his bike somewhere. I mean, there's plenty of muscle groups to be used with lots of different sports that don't require, you know, the 2 hours a day, Monday through Friday, intense stuff. But, you know, I think, again, a lot of that training is responsible for preventing injuries in kids when they do play the sport. So, you know, being smarter, having a better skill set is also going to be helpful for them not to get injured playing. So, I mean, a healthy balance is good. If it's, you know, one team sport they play, you know, then they should be active in other stuff, you know, whether it's bicycling or running track in the springtime or, you know, just something that isn't all football, because those muscles get worn and overused. And, you know, most kids don't get into the NBA or the NFL anyhow, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, I think, the overall thing, even like what I'm talking about is that what you're saying is the kid's young, let the kid be young. And right. that what they're saying is research is showing that really focusing in on that, no matter how old they are, doesn't really matter.
And you see in the article, the study, they had 1,200 youth athletes, and kids who specialized in one sport were 70 to 93% more likely to be injured than kids that played in multiple sports.
Right.
That's a lot.
Yeah, that's a big number to say, hey, let's not. And so, but they're also saying, and maybe I'm misunderstanding this, is that what they're saying is if you could just do football if that's all you're interested in, but just don't do football 12 months out of the year. Like, you don't want to be trying to find, unless it's just like throwing the ball around the backyard with your old man, you don't want to be doing drills and all this stuff and running around all the time. Do your football for 3 or 4 months in the fall and then take a break and find something else to do. Yeah,
absolutely. And then they say that kids that specialize in one sport get burned out. And one study showed that kids who played a single sport were more likely to quit and be less active as an adult. So that should be good evidence too.
But do you think then that they want people to be pushing their kids into other sports?
I don't know that you can push kids into other stuff.
Right?
You let them experience different sports between like 6 and 13 and see where their interests lie. You know, we have like a summer program here for the littler kids in town, camp type thing, where they get to experience football, basketball, baseball, and soccer. So it's like a 2-week camp, and the kids can try these things out before they actually have to commit to, you know, joining a team or a league or something. And I think those things are very helpful too. You know, we used to get exposed to those things in gym class, but now it's all fitness testing apparently.
They don't have to worry about any of that stuff. That's funny. All right.
And well, I forgot lacrosse, which is a biggie out this way. You guys have a lot of lacrosse out there, too?
I mean, I'm sure there's niches, but it's not as big. I was actually just talking to a friend about, I watched that All or Nothing on, if you have it on Amazon Prime, highly recommend the All Blacks, especially if you're a football fan, or I bet if you like soccer too, you would also enjoy rugby. And it's like an NFL Films. Like it's Hard Knocks. It's the training camp Hard Knocks for the All Blacks, the New Zealand rugby team. And it follows them. And it was really interesting to the point where I looked up, and we have an American rugby league, which I'm sure anybody listening from outside of the U.S. is laughing out loud about this. But when you tune in, it's interesting because it harkens me back to like when you see the old black and white photos of the NFL in its earliest days, is that there was nobody watching, you know, and so these guys are literally playing on an adapted high school football field. That's like, you're taking up part of the sideline because I think their pitch is bigger, and there's 40 people watching. It's televised, but it's very low grade, almost like public access cable. But this is a playoff game that I was watching. And but it's interesting. It's a fun sport to get into. And I was talking to her about that, and she goes, I've done the same thing for televised lacrosse here in the U.S. And she said, I think it's bigger on the East Coast than it is here. But I'm sure there's a bunch of people on the West Coast that love it. But just, it's not huge. It's not ginormous.
Yeah, because most of the football players here play football in the fall and lacrosse in the spring. So, you know, it almost encouraged that because they don't have any. We don't have year-round football here. So it almost forces them to play two sports.
Yeah, they have to. All right. Well, that was our show. So if you have a question for Dr. J, you can email it to me to show@thedadpodcast.com, and we could bring it up on the next episode. Don't forget to go to standuppediatrician.com to find if Dr. J is coming to a city near you. I know people are usually months
better
behind.
Chance of that if you live in Connecticut.
Oh, yes. If you're in the Northeast area, or if you were always wanted to see the changing of the leaves, that's coming up, right? Is Connecticut a part of that New England autumn sense?
We are part of New England, yes.
And how far of a drive is New England from, or is Connecticut from Vermont, would you guess?
You got to just basically go through Massachusetts. So it's about an hour, hour and a half.
Gosh, that's wild. And when you're on the West Coast, I got to tell you, like, just to drive halfway across California is 4 hours. I know it takes like 2 days to get across Texas. And it's funny because I was thinking about this. The reason I asked is I think Vermont and Virginia are both launching these like pilot programs where what they're doing with tech becoming what it is, and people are working remotely more and more. They're trying to lure people out of these high cost areas like California into lower cost of living states like Virginia. And I don't know what the cost of living is in Vermont off the top of my head, but I guess it's not that big. And so they're offering $10,000.
Cows than people in Vermont, by the way.
Oh, really? Okay. I did not know that.
That's a known fact, sure.
They're offering $10,000 if you work in a different area and can work remotely and you move and buy a house in Vermont, the state government will give you $10,000 to live there as a tax incentive to come say, hey, come live in our fair state and participate in our commerce.
That'll offset the alimony deductions you won't have anymore. So that'll work out for you.
If you're in the New England area, definitely hit up.
And if anyone can give me a spot when I'm out in San Francisco from August 25th to September 3rd.
Or recommend you mean a spot to stay? Because I'm sure you could get a couch in a minute.
No, we got a place to stay. I'm looking for some stage time while I'm out there.
Oh, yeah. So if you're a comic in the San Francisco or Bay Area and you want to, you got a showcase you're doing or whatever, throw our good old Dr. J a bone and get him up on there and do a show. Or how about this? How about this, Dr. J? This might even be a better chance. We've got a strong holding in the Bay Area. What if somebody has a large backyard and want to have 25 or so 30 friends come over and have Dr. J stop by, do about 15 minutes?
I'd love to do that. That would be fun.
All right. Send myself an email, or I'm sure you can email him at standuppediatrician.com. Hit him up on the Twitter at Dr. J Sute. All of the links for that are in the description of this episode. And we'll see you again in about a month. All right, Dr. J?
I hope we do, buddy. I hope you don't have to have another surgery and something else doesn't come up. But no, yes, I look forward to these. I look forward to talking to you.
The feeling is mutual, and the Worshams are of the mindset was that we have killed all of our medical issues for 10 years now. We did it all in 2 months.
You probably hit your high deductible this year too, right?
No, we have a great healthcare plan because of the bank. So I think I'm out so far. I think I'm out $200-$300 for both of us all told. I think is what it is because we have low copays. Good. So a lot of the companies are doing that low cost where it's like, hey, we're going to pay into a savings account for you and you have to pay us $1,000, that kind of stuff. Thankfully, I don't know how much I'm paying for that each month. That's just
I have to pay $5,000 before my insurance kicks in for anything for prescriptions. So like the first $5,000 is on me. So by June, July, if one of us has major surgery, I usually get free medicine the rest of the year.
See, and my fear is that I'm paying out the nose for to get the good coverage that I'm having. But because it's getting deducted from Natalie's check, I don't really see it. I don't look at her pay stubs. Her check just hits the account, and then I manage the money from there. But all right.
Oh, I get to take it out of my paycheck, too. But then you got to meet that high deductible of $5,000 before it actually starts paying anything.
It's working, guys. It's working.
You think it's working?
No, it's still,
All I know is that I have an important commodity. I went to medical school and I'm a good doctor. And it's so important that everyone is entitled to my care, but no one knows how to fucking pay me. That's the problem.
I'm sorry I'm laughing at your pay, but it's so true. And my fear is, and I'm sure it's a lot more closer to reality than it is just a fear in the ether, is that the real people making tons of money are these insurance providers and that none of the money is going to your doctors. And I think next down on that dole are the companies that own your family's practice. That's what I think it is.
right? Those are the people that are making, and we're just the grunts, the guys that actually went to medical school and spent 7 years of their young adult life learning the trade with very little compensation. We're the little grunts now on the totem pole of medicine.
Yeah, yeah, that's how it, there's always, no matter what, it's always best for the bottom guy in the totem pole. That's how it works out. Holding everybody up, but with little gain. Nobody looks down at the bottom guy. All right, on behalf of standuppediatrician.com, Dr. Jay Soutte, this is Justin Worship saying hug your kids, hump your loved one, and stay frosty, my friends.